Welcome to the First Century Church Podcast. My name is Stephen Wilhoy, and I'm the lead pastor at First Century Church, and it is an honor to have you with us today. The goal of the podcast is simple. We want you to be encouraged, challenged, and inspired to go further in your faith than ever before. If you'd like more information about the church, you can visit our website, firstcenturykc.com. And if you happen to be in the Kansas City area anytime soon, we'd love to have you join us for one of our live gatherings to connect with you in person. Again, thanks for joining us today, and we hope that you enjoy today's message. So one of the greatest baseball players of all time, without doubt, is Mickey Mantle. So he had an 18-year baseball career, all with the New York Yankees in the 50s and 60s. Let me give you some of his stats just to kind of show off a little bit for him. He had 536 home runs. That's before they had steroids, you know, so that's pretty impressive. 2,415 hits. He had a career batting average of .298, so just under that 300 mark. In his 18-year career, he played in 12 World Series and won 7 of them. And to this day, he still holds 6 World Series batting records that may never be broken. If you play in 12 World Series, you're going to probably have a few records if you bat that often and were as good a player as he was. But the most impressive thing about Mickey Mantle is that he was a switch hitter. So usually you're either a lefty or a righty. He could bat from either side of the plate. And so what's impressive and what's he's just a weapon, basically, is what he is. Because if you have a right-handed batter and you have a pitcher on the mound and they don't pitch well to right-handers, they're going to switch the pitcher if it's the right time of the game. Well, you can't do that with him because he'll just, you know, we'll walk over to this side and we'll go to the other side of the plate. He had that in him. So he's by far the best switch-hitting baseball player of all time and one of the top players of all time. But that switch-hitting is what really made it kind of an extra level for him. It was an amazing thing to behold. And today we're going to see that the Apostle Paul in Acts 17 is himself a switch hitter. We've seen already a lot of him going into synagogues, talking to the Jewish people, and even the God-fearers, people who aren't Jews, but they have an awareness of the God of the Jews. They have sort of an affinity for the God of the Jews, but they don't really know all the lingo. They're not part of the tribe. They're not ethnically Jewish, and so they're sort of in one camp. But we know that Paul had a specific ministry to Gentiles, to non-Jews. We've seen pockets so far here and there of him ministering to them, preaching to them, talking to them. But we're going to see him really switch hit, power hit today at the end of Acts 17, both this week and then next week, as he is in a new city. And we'll look at that here today, this new city of Athens. And so Paul has had kind of a rough go of it lately, if we don't remember. So he was in Thessalonica recently, and he was doing his thing, preaching the gospel, and an angry mob tried to find where they were. He and Silas, his ministry partner, were hiding, couldn't find them. Some of the believers there hid them and let them travel 44 miles to a different town called Berea. When they're there, kind of the same thing. They have some good results in Berea. The people there were eager for the word of the Lord. They studied God's word. They wanted to hear the message. But the people in Thessalonica followed them 44 miles to make more trouble in a different town. And so they have to kind of run again. This time they kind of split. So a couple of guys stay behind in Berea, but Paul goes all the way over 360 miles away to Athens, Greece. So this is where he finds himself in Athens. We'll talk about Athens a little bit, but let me just kind of explain. 300 to 400 years before Paul hits Athens, Athens was like the epicenter of the Western world, of the ancient world. It was the top, the Republic 300 years before was the top government really in history, really until we kind of adopted some of that in our own form of government. The education system of its time was unparalleled to most other major cities in antiquity. It was the height of philosophical thought. So you got guys like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, these old dudes with beards, you know, who are talking to each other all day, which is what we're going to look at a lot today. But by the time Paul gets there, it's kind of dwindled. Athens is not what it used to be. Its former glory is definitely former. It's behind it. And now it's the Roman Empire, and so it's a different type of world. However, thinking about the world and gaining knowledge and philosophy was still huge in Athens. It may not be at the height of what it was, but it's still, maybe even still at this time, the height of the then known world. So we're going to look at really quickly what Paul does when he first gets into Athens, what he sees and experiences and how he reacts in response to that, and then what he does about it. So let's start in Acts chapter 17, verse 16, as Paul steps off the boat from Berea, 360 miles from anybody that he knows on a brand new city. Here's what he finds, Acts 17, verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jew and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. So today in Acts 17, we're going to see philosophies collide. We're in this series called Collide. We're going to see three major philosophies of this day, and I would even argue, even of today, even if they're of a different name, three major philosophies collide. Let's look at the setting here. I've got a few pictures I'll show you. So the Areopagus is this, it's this rocky part. I even got it circled for you so you know exactly where this is. It's this rocky outcropping here is where Paul is in Athens. It's still there to this day. And so he's here with these philosophers talking about philosophy, which we'll see his is more than just that. So Areopagus in the Greek, it really means the hill of Ares. So Ares was a Greek and Roman god. He was the god of war. So this point in Roman mythology is important because Ares was accused of murdering another one of the deities of the pantheon, okay, or one of their children. So he actually goes on trial here and is acquitted of murder. So that to this day, it's called the Areopagus, the hill of Ares, or Mars Hill is another term that you might have heard of. This is called Mars Hill because Ares and Mars, Greek and Roman, different name for the same guy, okay? So that's where this is. That's where Paul is here. And this is where the philosophers would gather and discuss the topics of the day, the meaning of life, epistemological questions. Too big of a word for me to get out in one try, but I got it finally. These huge questions of life in the universe. So if you look just to the east, southeast, up the hill, you'll see the Acropolis there and the Parthenon, which includes the Athena's temple. And so that's the view there. If you look to the north of where Paul is, you'll see the rest of Athens in kind of a beautiful shot of up to the north here. You can see the city of Athens. That's what Paul's looking at here in the first century. It's going to look very much like it did 2,000 years ago, which is incredible. And the last picture I want to show you is a bronze plaque that has been fixed to the bottom of this outcropping, this rock outcropping. It was a bronze plaque commissioned in around 1938, and the text is in ancient Koine Greek, and it's Paul's sermon from Acts 17. So this commission put Paul's sermon here from this location on this bronze plaque. And so I've told Kim, we have to go to Athens before I die. We have to go see these things. I want to see them. I want to be there to see these things. And so we'll see. We'll save up for the rest of our life, and maybe we'll just retire in Greece. Would that be good? We could do that. We could start a church there. We could be missionaries in Greece, right? Sounds like a good retirement plan. So this is where Paul is 2,000 years ago talking to these philosophers as these philosophies collide. And so today's going to be a little bit different. I hope you can hang with me. I've been struggling for the last few days on what to do about this because we're going to look at most of our time is going to be the other two viewpoints, the other two philosophies that are here in Acts 17. We just see what their titles are, and we're going to look at them and then finish with Paul's opening introduction to his philosophy and see how they differ, how it differs from the other two. Then next week, we'll flesh out the rest of his sermon and look specifically at what Paul's arguments are for why his philosophy is superior to the others that are here in Acts 17. So it's going to be a little bit different, but I think it'll be good if we can stick to it to the end, okay? So I'm going to stop apologizing right now for what we're going to do and just go for it, okay? So we have these two main schools of thought that Luke mentions in Acts 17. We have Epicureanism and Stoicism. The Epicureans and the Stoics are here with Paul. They're the two main ancient philosophies of their day. And I would argue similar ways that people think today. Most people fall into one of these two camps, and we'll make those connections to our modern culture. Let's look at these two today and then look at Paul's argument here before we close. So the first group are the Epicureans. So let's look quickly at Epicurean philosophy. You probably did not imagine you're going to learn about ancient Greek philosophy today, but welcome to first century. We're glad you're here, all right? And I'll just say this is probably one of my favorite parts of Acts because I love studying this kind of stuff. And so if I get a little nerdy, just, you know, forgive me for that, all right? So we're going to give a brief overview here of what the Epicureans believe so you can kind of get a view of what they're thinking as they're hearing Paul's message. Because you're probably more familiar with Paul's view already, even without explaining it. You already know what Christianity basically is. So we're going to see where they're coming from and their viewpoints. So Epicureanism was founded in the late 300s BC by a guy named Epicurus. It's amazing. He just named it after himself. It just makes total sense. The main goal of this worldview is pleasure or happiness. The goal of Epicureanism is how can I gain the most pleasure and avoid the most pain? Does that sound familiar to anybody else? We still live that way. Most people do today. Now, it's ethical, okay? We would also maybe call it hedonism. Just I want happiness and pleasure in my life as the ultimate goal. So now there's an ethical aspect to it. So it's not like this person doesn't make me happy so I can kill them. Well, that's not allowed. It's not anything goes here. Or it's not that these things that this person has will make me happy, so I'm going to take them from them. There's an ethical component to it, but still, the goal is to maximize happiness and to minimize pain. So Epicurus, in the introduction to his classic work, The Art of Happiness, he says this, "The purpose of all knowledge is to achieve ataraxia, which is the freedom from irrational fears and anxieties of all sorts, in brief, peace of mind." Again, this is still the goal of many today. This is the goal of life, is to be happy, to experience the most pleasure possible. My pleasure is what's supreme. I want to limit the pain in my life. I don't want to do anything that's going to stretch me too far or cause too much discomfort. And we today live in this hedonistic, pleasure-filled, pleasure-me-first kind of culture. Our culture tells us, if it feels good, do it. If it sounds great, go for it. That's how we live, and that's kind of why we're in the mess that we are in. That's the goal, is pleasure and happiness. And they're also what you would call materialists. So I guess Madonna was an Epicurean, right? Because we're living in a material world, and she's a material girl, so maybe she's an Epicurean. I don't know, but that's just where my brain goes with this kind of thing. I make those connections. So when I say materialist, I don't mean in the pursuit of happiness, I need all this stuff. By materialist, I mean an Epicurean would think the only things that I can physically experience are what actually exist. Anything outside of my material experience is not real, does not exist. It's a physical type of mentality. So Epicurus, in one of his other great works, The Letter to Herodotus, he explains it this way. He says, nothing is generated from the non-existent. So that's getting into a big thing that we'll look at in a minute as well. The totality of things was always just as it is at present and will always remain the same because there is nothing into which it can change, inasmuch as there is nothing outside the totality that could intrude and affect change. So a lot of words basically to say we don't believe in any supreme, powerful being that created the universe. There's no supernatural at all. It's not physical material, so I can't believe in that way of living. There is only what we can experience. So an Epicurean would say, I can only gain knowledge by what I can sense. I can only know from what I can see with my physical eyes and feel physically. Within this is an idea that's sort of depressing, but it gets worse in the other school of thought. Epicureans were what we would call determinists. So their view is every action in the universe is set on a specific course and cannot be altered. The problem Epicurus noticed when he made this claim, like you write this, you chisel it probably literally in stone, you're going to find there are exceptions to that rule that I just made. That's the problem that he had. Because he could even see in the natural world, something might be going on a certain trajectory for millions of miles and all of a sudden it takes a left turn. Well, was it designed to do that all along, or is there something making it switch? Well, I don't believe in what I can't see, and so I've got to have another way to explain that. Even the idea of human free will, he wanted to give sort of an allowance for that because he could see it at work and I can experience free will. Someone's my friend for years and years and years, and all of a sudden they backstab me or they, you know, do something terrible toward me. So there's got to be a way to explain that in natural terms. And so for the caveat for this idea of determinism, everything's going to be as it is, he had what's called the swerve. Which is weird, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, but this is kind of his thing. Every once in a while, when you look at things, something changes at the last minute. There's got to be a material reason for that. There's no supernatural reason. There's nothing outside of nature that causes things to change or alter on the course they're on. So he kind of made up this idea of the swerve. Things will suddenly shift, whether it's in nature or in human nature. He had this idea to acknowledge free will. And it can change certain things in certain ways that we didn't see coming till the very last second. But it's not a supernatural power at work. It's got to be something that we can physically experience in our life. It's not divine. It's within the natural order. So with that idea, there's no personal God. There's no divine creator who has relationship with his people. That's not a thing. He doesn't govern over human affairs in Epicurean philosophy. We saw that in the previous quote, but here he says it again later in the same letter. He says, if you recognize and cling to these truths, you will see that nature is freed forthwith and delivered from her haughty overlords, and that she does all of her own will without divine action. So his argument is nature just does what it does. It's set on a course. It follows that course. Nothing can alter it. Nothing can change it. Nothing can stop it. It's been determined. It's just how it is. Only what I can see and experience is real. There's no creator. There's no personal creative force. And that's really how our modern science still functions. It still works in the same way. There can't be anything outside of what we can physically know, so we just have to, you know, have some unknowns, but we try to figure it out scientifically. How can I see this in physical space, not in supernatural terms? And this is how, really, we thought of the universe until about 100 or so years ago. And then we had a problem that we think of as Christians as a problem now, but it was a problem for the scientific world initially, and that is the Big Bang Theory. So for Epicurus, they thought, and until about 100 years ago, scientists thought the universe was ever expanding and was eternal. It's always existed, always been here. But then you have this theory that says, well, no, if you go down, 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 back, there's got to be a starting point to the universe. There's something, it's got to be a point where it all began. So it's the Big Bang Theory. Now, initially, the scientific world was not crazy about this because of the religious implications that it seemed to support. And in the 100 years or so since then, it's sort of been shifted and changed to now where Christians try to argue against the Big Bang Theory, even though it clearly and easily gets us to Genesis 1 without really much of an argument. And so science has been a weird thing in turning that on its head, but it's done that. But the Epicureans would not have seen it that way. They would have said everything's always been here. Nature works on its own. It has nothing outside of it to alter it in any way. And then not only is that how you live your life, which is kind of a terrible way to live and think. Everything's determined. Everything's there. There's no one outside affecting anything. But then when it comes to the end of life or the afterlife, here is kind of their main view on that. One more quote from Epicurus. He says this, since the soul's substance is seen to be mortal, death is nothing to us, nor does it concern us in the least. Just so when we shall no longer be, after the divorcing of body and soul, of which twain we are fitly joined, I love that line, nothing whatsoever will have the power to affect us, since we shall not then be. So again, a lot of words to say this simple idea. If there's no body, there's no experience. So if you're dead and there's something inside of you that is the soul, which is weird for them to even talk about because you can't experience the soul in a physical way. But if those are apart, if there's no body doing anything, there's no experience to be had. So then there's nothing after this life is over. They would not affirm an afterlife in any way. That's why when Paul's talking about the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, they're like, what are you talking about? That is the craziest thing I've ever heard. That can't happen. That doesn't happen because I can't experience that type of thing. That doesn't happen in nature. Even if you put the swerve, well, Jesus, the resurrection was the swerve. That'd be a stretch even for them. And so we just simply cease to be after this life is over. And it's even today a common belief of humanists and atheists, right? That this is all there is. Nothing after this. There's no judgment. There's no reward. There's no punishment. It's this life. We're done. We're worm food in the dirt. That's it. So that's a very, 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 very broad treatment of this philosophy. There's a lot more to it. Believe me, I didn't even scratch the surface on that. But that's sort of what one school of thought is that Paul's here talking about. So you can kind of see where it's a very opposite sort of worldview of where Paul's going to be coming from. And they're going to have a hard time in many ways with what he's going to tell them, which we're going to do more and more next week. But then we have the Stoics as well. So we have the Epicureans and we have the Stoics. So let's look at Stoicism, which has some similarities, but they're different for a reason, okay? Stoicism actually dates back a little further, about 400 BC, by a guy named Zeno, not the warrior princess. Okay, Zeno with an O at the end. So there you go. And to be fair to Stoicism, it has a lot more similarities to Christianity than Epicureanism would. Let me give you an example. So Marcus Aurelius, who was a second century Roman emperor, he was a Stoic, probably the most famous Stoic of all time. In his book, Meditations, he writes many things, but this is one of them. If it is not right, do not do it. If it is not true, do not say it. That sounds pretty biblical, doesn't it? Like, that sounds like something Paul might write in the New Testament. That sounds like a proverb that Solomon may have written a couple thousand years before, right? And so Stoicism, in its roots, because it deals with reason, is more similar to Christianity, but it's still lacking a huge component that we'll look at before we close here even today. So, as I mentioned, Epicureans relied on experience, right? The physical world is how I gain knowledge. Stoics relied on reason and logic for everything. Okay, so that's why even today, if someone is Stoic, they seem like they don't have any emotions. That's where that comes from, because it's all reason. It's like I'm basically a robot with skin on. That's kind of like me. So I'm a Stoic. If I weren't a Christian, I'm definitely a Stoic. All right, so I'm maybe a Stoic Christian if I want to be fair to myself in that way. Okay, so I'm basically a robot with skin on. That's how I roll. That's who I am. Okay, so Stoics are not completely emotionless. However, they will reason through their emotions, which is good, but there's a limit to it. So they wouldn't say don't have emotion. They would say, does that emotion make sense? Is it logical to have this emotion in this situation? So an example would be a Stoic would look at someone mourning at a funeral, and they would say, that makes sense. Someone just died, they're sitting there, maybe it's the spouse, or maybe it's a close family member. That logically makes sense. They can have their moment and cry. However, if you look at 25 years later and they're still weeping like it's the first day, a Stoic would probably argue that's illogical. They should not behave that way. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm saying that's where the Stoics are coming from. It's reason. It's logic. Does this make logical sense? Should this be the result of what's happening? And so that's where the Stoics are. And a big part of that, I think a big weakness of that too, and a barrier to the Christian faith for a Stoic would be they rely on self-reliance and self-dependence to the top, to the nth degree. So Seneca, who was a first century Stoic philosopher, so he's a contemporary of Paul, this guy that we're going to read from in just a second, he was living and writing at the same time as Paul here in Athens, okay? So Seneca writes this as a Stoic philosopher. He says, external circumstances have very little importance, either for good or for evil. The wise man is neither elated by prosperity nor depressed by adversity, for he has always endeavored to depend chiefly upon himself and to derive all his joys from himself. So a Stoic would say, I make my own luck. I don't need anybody else for anything in my life. I'm a self-made man. I'm a self-made woman, right? And they would also say, if I do the right thing, I will get the result that I want. The problem is, how long have you lived life? And have you seen that to not be true much of the time? You can do all of the right things logically, and something in the works is going to mess up your plan. Something is going to change and alter what you thought was going to happen, but that's where the Stoics were. They would also, you know, we're not going to let anything get to us. We're not going to let, you know, external circumstances that says bring us too high or take us down too low. There's an independence and a self-reliance that these Stoic philosophers here would have. And Paul's saying, you've got to depend completely on Jesus. That's going to be a stretch for them when they hear the gospel presented to them here in Acts 17. They're going to say, no, it's about me and what I can do and how much I can muster, and I make my own luck and I'm my own person independently of anyone else. So that's part of their self-reliance, self-dependence. So also when it comes to God or the divine, they, like the Epicureans, don't hold to a personal view of a personal God. There's no divine force who cares about his creation. Now, they do acknowledge the Greek and Roman gods that we're familiar with, you know, Zeus and Hercules and all these, you know, Mars on Mars Hill. Like they would acknowledge their existence, but wouldn't say they're involved in the affairs of people. They just kind of do their own thing, which even as you read some of the myths, they kind of don't care about the people. at all. We'll tell a story next week that illustrates that point pretty easily. So they acknowledge these false Roman gods, but they're not personally connected or involved in the affairs of men. Now, with that, though, the divine to them is sort of verges on pantheism, which if you don't know what that is, but think of like a hippie. God is in everything, man. Everything is God, man. It's so groovy, man. That's kind of what a Stoic would be like. They really verge on pantheism when it comes to, there's not a creator God who's apart from his creation, who made everything, who is involved with his creation. No, the tree is God, man, and God is that tree. That chair is God, man, and God is that tree. And I am God, and you are God, and we are God, and it's all God, man. That's kind of what the Stoic, now they wouldn't have that weird accent like I'm doing, you know. They were hippies before it was cool to be a hippie, all right? So to give an illustration of this, here's what, back to Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor from the second century, he writes this. Think always of the universe as one living creature, comprising one substance and one soul, man. Groovy. I added that part in, you can tell. How all is absorbed into this one consciousness, how a single impulse governs all its actions, how all things collaborate in all that happens, the very web and mesh of it all. So he's saying clearly the universe is just one big blob. You're just one part of one big blob. It's just this thing. You know, the universe is not even in anything, or it just is, man. It's so cool. I gotta stop doing that, all right? He's saying we're all part of this universal consciousness. We're all together in this sort of divine universe that we're all equally a part of. But along with this, so if you thought we talked about determinism, you know, everything happens except for the swerve. So Stoics are even more depressing than that. So they're what we would call fatalists. They would say every moment of the universe is planned in advance and is set on a specific course and can never be altered in any way. If something's meant to happen, it's going to happen, and nothing can stop that thing from happening. So they would kind of be like the que sera, sera kind of people as well. Whatever will be, will be. I can't control anything. There's no God to control. There's no God to pray to change anything. There's nothing that can alter anything that's going to happen to me in my life. That's a fatalist point of view, and it's kind of a depressing way to live, but that's where that made logical sense to the Stoics. And that's true also, one more quote, and then we'll get to some other things here in a second. It's also true of the afterlife, how they thought of the afterlife as well, or the lack thereof, if you will. So again, Seneca, the first century Stoic philosopher, the contemporary of Paul, about the afterlife, he says this, "Reflect that the dead suffer no evils, that all those stories which make us dread the netherworld are mere fables, that he who dies need fear no darkness, no prison, no blazing streams of fire, no river of Lethe, no judgment seat before which we must appear, and that death is such utter freedom that he need fear no more despots. All that is a fantasy of the poets who have terrified us without a cause." So the Stoic would say, after you're dead, you're gone. There's no judgment, there's no reward, there's no punishment, it's over. Because it doesn't make logical, reasonable sense to assume that your soul's going to go to another region of the universe and that there's a God who's going to judge you based on how you lived or didn't live your life. It doesn't make logical sense to them. It's not reasonable to make those claims. And so he even says here, that talk of afterlife is simply a scare tactic of poets or of people of probably other faiths as well. So for both these philosophies, death really is freedom, but it's freedom to not exist anymore. It's freedom to cease to exist. So that's kind of what Paul's looking at here. That's who he's, I give you a lot of backstory here. That's why it's going to take 2 weeks to get through this. To kind of see who Paul is surrounded by. He's all alone by himself, 300, almost 400 miles away from anybody that he knows, and he's surrounded by all of these really smart intellectual thinkers who have all the universe figured out in their philosophy. And here he is with this kind of burgeoning new thing that doesn't even really, it's not called Christianity probably quite yet, but he's going to try to explain to them what he believes. But before we get into that, let me just sum up these two worldviews very quickly. You can tell, even if you don't know much about Christianity, you can tell that these two ways of living, these two philosophies on their own are incomplete. They're lacking something. They're unreliable on their own as a worldview. Because look at it again. If you're an Epicurean and all you care about is what you can experience, well, how you feel at the moment can really mess up your life, can it? If you go by your experience and how you feel and what you want in the moment, I want happiness here, boy, can that really mess up your life. Man, that can derail your career. It can ruin your marriage. It can harm your children. It can ruin nations, right? Because I want this thing, because I experience life this way. I'm going to live in that trajectory, and that's just how it's going to be. That's not a great way to live. Let me give you an example, because sometimes your experience can be wrong, right? So until about 500 years ago, we thought the sun revolved around the earth, didn't we? That was our experience. That's how we saw the world. Well, boy, were we wrong. And so we've learned a lot since then, but if you live your life on only your experience, you're going to go down maybe some really wrong paths and destroy your life. So this philosophy on its own does not work. If you live based from experience to experience, you're going to let anger control you. You're going to let your lust control you. You're going to let fear control you, right? And so if we go by just our experience, it's not going to lead us down the path that we desire. But if you're a Stoic and you go on reason alone, it's also not enough. Because you can reason yourself out of really good decisions, can't you? You can talk yourself. You can list 85 reasons why this is the right decision, and then you find three on the other side that don't. You're like, well, I'm not doing that thing because it's not 85 to zero. You can reason yourself out of a lot of good things. So, for instance, let's say you've met Mr. or Miss Right. You know, you're looking for somebody. I've been on the dating scene for a while. I've met the right person. They're perfect for me. Everything lines up. Okay, and everyone approves. It's like, well, all the reasons are there. Like, boom, boom, all the check marks, all the boxes are filled. This is amazing. But then you decide, you know what? I'm blonde, and I want blonde kids. They have jet black hair. Well, I'm not going to get that if I marry them, so I'm going to, you know, not marry them. And you've maybe missed out on Mr. or Miss Right for that one reason. You've reasoned yourself out of what could have been a great thing. The opposite can also be true. You can also reason yourself into a really bad relationship, and then people are like, don't do it, don't do it. Oh, but this and this and this are great. And you end up reasoning yourself into destruction. Or you can do it this way. You can reason yourself out of a great opportunity because of, let's say, a job. Let's say you have, and this is probably because, you know, we're in this mode, so it's in my brain, right? So let's say, and this is, you can take my advice if you want. You don't have to. It's just an example. This is not about you, but it's not about you, Kim. No. But let's just say you have like three job offers on the table. The reasoning for, I could pick the one that pays the most because that's reasonable for me to do, right? But then what happens is, because you're thinking about reason or logic, you ignore the culture of those places, and it's got the worst culture of all. But that's not reason. That's kind of, you know, it's subjective. It's kind of feelings and experience. I'm a Stoic. I'm going by hard numbers. So I'm going by which pays the most because the culture thing is subjective, blah, blah, blah. And you get in there and you hate the job because you ignored this thing because it wasn't reasonable to go that route. So you can talk yourself in or out of a good or bad thing if you just base your life on reason. How you feel can be misleading. What looks great on paper can be misleading. So the question is there a better alternative? Is there a better way to live your life than the Epicureans or the Stoics would want us to live? How our culture wants us to live? By just what I can see and feel and how I experience things, or what just makes sense? I'm not going to go with that floofy faith stuff because it's not reasonable or logical. Is there a better way? Paul says there is a better way. So he shares his philosophy. We'll get to the very introduction of it today and launch into the rest of his message next week. So you want to catch this next week. You want to be back next week to catch the second part of this as Paul gets into his philosophy of Christianity. So we have the Epicureanism, we have Stoicism, now we have Christianity. And you probably know many of the core beliefs of what Paul's going to say. But what I want us to do for a few minutes today and then into next week is see why Paul goes the specific direction that he does. He knows his audience. He knows their objections. He knows their philosophies, and he's going to speak directly to them and how he presents the gospel of Jesus Christ as his philosophy. Well, let's take the last few minutes here this morning and look at his introduction and how he starts to set himself apart from these other groups. So Acts 17, verses 22 and 23, as he starts his argument here on Mars Hill. It says, Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you." So just looking at these two verses for just a few minutes, we're going to see how he immediately sets his philosophy apart from theirs and shows how it's different and why it's a better alternative for them. So he sets this major distinction. Here's the major thing I want to show, the distinction that Paul makes at the outset here. The major distinction between Paul's philosophy, we're going to call it that for now, so don't get offended, I'm calling Christianity a philosophy, although it kind of is. But his worldview versus theirs, the major distinction he's making at the outset here is that philosophy is about asking questions, but less concerned about finding concrete answers. Like, you can take years of philosophy courses and ask a ton of questions and come up with different ideas or different versions of the right answer and never come to a concrete determination about anything. There's always that swerve involved. Well, everything works 98% of the time except for the swerve here, and that's kind of my out for everything. That's how philosophy as a discipline sort of works. It's more abstract. But Paul says, no, I've discovered what you're asking about. All these questions that you've spent hundreds of years discussing and arguing, I know what you're looking for. I've got the answer to your questions. That's the main distinction that Paul's making here, is that his is not an abstract philosophy. It's a concrete way of life. You can bank on it. You can build your life on it. It's not just the study of knowledge. It's the pursuit of truth. So it's not questions and discussions, ideas, but it is truth. So Paul says, you know, basically he's saying here in Acts 17, you're asking great questions. I just happen to know what the answer is, so check this out, and then we'll move on to that next week. But what he does first is he notices their temples, their idols, their shrines, you know, all their gods and altars, and he says, I can see you're very religious. So what Paul's doing here is he's kind of buttering them up because they want to be very religious. They're like, yeah, we have all these altars and shrines and gods because we worship all the gods. We're not leaving anybody out. So he's saying, yeah, this is great. This is good. You're very, very religious. He says you even have an altar to an unknown god. So there's a couple of reasons why this could be, and they're very similar, but it could be that they just had this here just in case they missed one. In case we have 99 of the 100 gods, but we don't have him named or her named, this is for them, you know? Or if there's more gods that come up later they didn't even know existed, this will cover their base here to an unknown god. But Paul says, but you don't even know what you're worshiping. Wouldn't you like to know what you're worshiping? Wouldn't you like to know what you're devoting yourself to? Wouldn't you like to know what you're sacrificing to? You probably would. Paul says, you don't know that. You're ignorant of what you're worshiping. But he says, but I know. And our modern culture is very much the same. It's very religious. Our culture is very religious, whether they realize it or not, whether they acknowledge it or not. Our culture is very religious. And the reason is we can't help it. We're hardwired by a personal creator to worship. Now, the object of our worship is supposed to be him. But the problem is we misappropriate our worship. We misuse our worship. We misplace our worship. And Paul in Romans 1, a couple years later, he would write this. He would say in Romans 1, God created everything so we could know him and worship him. The problem is most people worship what he created and not him as the creator, and the result is sin and catastrophe. So that's his same line of reasoning even years later in his letter to the Romans. People even today are ignorant in their worship. They worship unknown gods. People around you all the time worship unknown gods. They think it's success. They give it a name, but it's really an unknown. It's a false god. They worship success. They worship power. They worship money. They worship popularity. They worship all these things that they think will fill them, but it's an unknown false god that will not deliver what it promises to deliver. They're still searching, still empty by worshiping this unknown god. So like Paul, you and I, if you're a follower of Jesus, you've discovered the answer to the questions of your neighbors and coworkers and family members and friends. We know who we're worshiping. We're not ignorant of who we're worshiping. It's not an abstract philosophical idea that we've built our life on. It's a certain concrete, never-changing answer, and it's Jesus. That's the difference that Paul's saying from the outset. You're worshiping false gods. You're very religious, but you're kind of wandering into nothingness. He said, I've got an answer that will change your life. I've got the answer to all of the questions that you've been debating for hundreds of years. And so maybe you find yourself even here today, you're asking endless existential questions about life. Or maybe you know someone who's always asking about the meaning of this and the purpose of that and what's my reason for living and what am I supposed to do with my life? There's an answer that you can discover, that they can discover, that Paul tells us here, and it's found in Jesus. Maybe you've tried, you know, living like an Epicurean, and pleasure is your goal, and happiness is the main idea, and it's the only thing I care about is what I can see and experience. The result is emptiness. There's still a longing in the heart of one who lives that way. If you live your life like a Stoic, all I can do is what makes sense, what's reasonable, what's logical, you know, what fits within my worldview. If you live that way, you're going to live a cold, dead life with no meaning, and then it all ends in nothingness anyway. That's a pretty terrible worldview to have. Many people live that way. There's a better way. Paul says Jesus is that better way. He's the answer to the question. He's this concrete ideal and not this, you know, sort of idea that's out there somewhere in the universe. And that's why, as we close, in John chapter 1, John expresses Jesus in John chapter 1 as the Logos, which means logic. You would say, oh, he's a Stoic. He says Jesus is logic. It's not what he's saying. He's using that same word, logos, logic, that a Stoic would look at and say, I like that. And he would say, no, he's not just logic. He is the logic of the universe. He is God. He is eternal. He is creator. He is God the Son. So that's why John uses that word very well there. He's not just reason, but he is the reason for the universe. He's not just logical, but he is the logic of the universe. You see, in Jesus, all of our questions are answered. In Jesus, all meaning is found. In Jesus, the search for purpose is complete. In Jesus, life can really begin in a meaningful way. In Jesus, you can worship what you know and not be ignorant anymore and searching. And in Jesus, you can be who you were made to be. That's the distinction that Paul is making. Again, I know we went through a lot of other stuff there to get to that point, but that's why we did that, to drive home this point, that these other ways of life do not work. On their own, your experience is not enough, your reason is not enough, but Jesus supersedes those, and he is enough. That's the offer of Jesus, and that is the life-changing, life-altering philosophy of Jesus. Let's pray as we close today. God, in our modern search for truth and meaning and purpose, may we realize that we can find it in Jesus, that Jesus is the ultimate experience, he's the ultimate reality, he's the ultimate logic and reason for living. Other philosophies come and go, they're not enough. Other worldviews don't measure up, they're not enough, but Jesus is enough. So may we see the people around us who are worshiping these unknown gods, whatever they are, whether it's money or relationships or acceptance or power or influence or happiness or just pleasure in general, whatever that is, it's not going to be enough for them. Give us the boldness like Paul to stand firmly and say, that kind of life will not lead you where you think it will. That kind of thinking will not be enough. Your reason will leave you wanting. Your experience and lust for pleasure will not be enough, but Jesus is enough. He answers every question. He solves every problem. He is the solution to what you've been longing for. Help us to be like Paul, to have that message deep down in our hearts, to know the difference between what Jesus offers, which is everything, and what the world offers, which is not enough. It sounds great, but it's not enough. It sounds like what we want, but it's not enough. Only in Jesus, in following him and believing in him and putting him first in our lives, depending upon him and not ourselves, experiencing him and not ourselves, can we find what we're looking for. Even this week, give us divine appointments. Put us in specific, strategic locations to meet people who need to know about Jesus. They're longing for something. They're looking for something. They feel afraid. They feel angry, they feel confused, they feel lack in their life. Help us to explain to them the answer is Jesus. The solution is Jesus. The peace they need, the logic that they seek is found in Jesus. He is the solution to every problem, the answer to every question. It is Jesus. That's the difference. That's the philosophy, the way of life that will change everything. Help us to live that way and to share that message with those around us boldly to see their eyes open and their lives changed by the power of Jesus. God, I pray you give us a great week this week. Help us to be full of faith in Jesus and bring us back next time ready for more of you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.